Okay, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest, a returning guest we spoke 3 weeks ago about his book that he published titled Two Masters and Two Gospels. And we really only covered really some of the introductory stuff in the book. The subtitle of the book, by the way, is The Teaching of Jesus Versus the Leaving of the Pharisees in Talk Radio and Cable News, published 2020. His name is J. Michael Bennett. I was on his show about 11 years ago. The title of that show is Future Quake, an excellent show. It's a great repository of information. So you can go check that out at www.futurequake.com. And he has also published two books. One is How to Overcome the Most Frightening Issues You Will Face This Century, and also Pandemonium's Engine, and was a researcher and on-camera host of the documentary Dark Clouds Over Elberton, The True Story of the Georgia Guidestones, the Monoliths in Georgia, and also publishes at the Two Spies Report on WordPress. So it's all one word, twospiesreport.wordpress.com. And also his website is www.mikebennettbooks.com. And it's dedicated to news about his published works. And the title of the interview I did with him back in August 2010 was titled The Legacy of Aleister Crowley and His Shadow on the Events of 9/11. And you can go back and look at that. And our earlier interview was on June 28th of 2021. So we're going to kind of get back into the text. It's a very superbly researched book and really goes into the kind of background of kind of modern Christianity, American Christianity, and its leaving that I think I said in the last interview, you know, people have to know about this so they can understand or see what the difference between this public Christianity is and what's in the biblical text. So Mike can go more into that. So Michael Bennett, are you there?
Man, it's a privilege to be on the show again tonight. And I thank all your listeners for putting up with me. I know it probably sounded a little preachy last time, but I'm assuming that they're really into alternative history a little bit, or revisionist kind of stuff. In other words, what's really going down with some stuff that has been purposely sort of swept under the rug. And that's really the core of the book. And hopefully we'll dig into that tonight. And I really think it's going to be more of a cup of tea of most of your listeners that are discerning kind of folks trying to get down to the bottom of what's going on in society.
I agree. So, I mean, we were talking about Franklin Graham and talking about Falwell Jr., if I recollect, and kind of went through some of the elements of your book where you compared the gospel of Christ or Jesus with the gospel of Hannity, Fox News, and conservative. And I know before we kind of got into this interesting character, James Fifield, who your book really opened my eyes into that character because I've seen his church. It's a very predominant church close to downtown LA. Right now, it's really on the eastern side of what would be known as Koreatown, but we can get into that. But I know that you want to kind of pick up a little bit before that, so maybe you can just go into what you'd like to cover.
Okay. Well, the reason why, and again, thanks again for being on the show. The reason why I go into that was, like the material we covered last time, I discovered in my research that, you know, when people I knew who were, I live in the Bible Belt, so most everybody's church-going folk. And when I would find when they talk about public issues, they wouldn't really talk about the stuff in the Bible that they said that their life was based on. It was also talking about talking points I heard on talk radio and cable news. And so it was really a search to figure out why did this become their new gospel? And a lot of it's just because they were saturated with hearing it every day on talk radio and cable news and seeing it on TV and their commutes and, you know, just overwhelmed saturation. But the fact is, I pointed out, was that the whole attitude and mindset was one of what I call the wealth class that really, really looked down on people who are less fortunate or are poor or the working class. They don't want any kind of assistance for people to get back on their feet or even for old people or military. They hate the government. The government's inherently evil. And when I went through the Bible, which they say they base their life on, there was no overlap. There was nothing that was there that was matching. I mean, it really speaks well of the poor and of the stranger and the immigrant and that they should get extra grace. And it talks about how hard it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom and their values. And so when there's no overlap between what all these Christians around me in my neighborhood live and then what they say, I had to dig and find out how did that disconnect happen. And that's where we get into tonight is the history. I had to go back and dig stuff that I was never shown growing up or in church or anything of how Christian media really got established in the 20th century and how who were the people who began teaching this wealth class value system and put the whole teaching of the Bible on its ear. And it was really all I ever heard growing up. And beyond my local church, when cable TV came along, I started seeing the TV preachers. But it wasn't just the Jim and Tammys and those kind. It was like everybody was teaching this different value system. The Bible prophecy community had a lot of it too. And then the internet came along and sort of blew it wide open. So what I found in my research, and I think you've mentioned before too, it was stuff that you didn't know as well, true, nor hardly anybody else I've ever met knew, was that for all my fellow Christians talk about how they're on the ball and discernment and they're providing advice and guidance to everyone else in America and they know what's really going on. What I have sadly found out is that they're some of the most gullible people that I've ever met. And I don't say that happily. And what I'm going to show you was that how easily they were co-opted even before the middle of the 20th century. Now, we know they've been co-opted by popes and kings and other ideologies and Salem witch trials. But in the time of our parents and grandparents, that's when mass media was born. And before I get into how big business and the corporate world actually officially took over and established Christian media, mass media, I used an example at the beginning of that section. It's like a 100-page chapter in the book. I began with an example, sort of an appetizer for the reader to show how easily the Christian community was easily co-opted for somebody else's agenda. And the example I used was the situation that happened after World War II, when believe it or not, the historical references I found showed that President Truman and other government officials were worried that Americans were going to be attracted to what was perceived as the more egalitarian nature of communism. And they were afraid that communism was going to catch on in America. And so what they decided was the only way to fight communism was to make it a religious holy war. Because the only thing they felt comfortable showing that was for the people and not against the people, like the bankers and the rich folk, was to emphasize the atheism that was practiced in Bolshevik-type communism. And so to do that, they wanted to build a belief system, a civil religion that made basically what I would call mujahideen or holy warriors out of the entire populace, not just the soldier in the field, definitely them, but the whole populace. So they actually took all of the guys who were experts at PSYOPs in America, and this was during the Truman administration. They got the guys who were the wartime propagandists for World War II. And in fact, one of the key ones was Eisenhower. General Eisenhower formed a fake group of German dissidents in World War II that actually were all American GIs, but they were broadcasting in German radio as if they were a resistance movement when it was nothing but American GIs. So they had several groups that learned how to do black propaganda. And then you had the Ad Council. You probably heard the Ad Council. It was really known as the War Ad Council, and it was to sell war to the American public. Well, all these people were brought together. Then they brought all of the top CEOs of the biggest American corporations, the White House did, as well as some of our leading theologians and Christian leaders.
Right. I think and you mentioned Reinhold Niebuhr. Yeah,
he was involved, and later Billy Graham was involved. Norman Vincent Peale was in the middle of it. And one of the key events they had was an event at the White House in May 1947, where they brought the religious leaders, intelligence officials, and corporate people. This was all hush-hush. And they released a report with this new brand that they came up with called One Nation Under God, And this was a new slogan they wanted to sell to develop a civil religion. Now, the scary thing for a lot of us who've been raised in a conservative world or in church, you sort of think that all this stuff talking about America, you know, with their knees bowed, like, you know, Valley Forge with George Washington, that all this stuff and the Christian aims of the founding fathers goes back to the time when our nation was founded. Well, most of the stuff that David Barton and people like that sort of preach about our Christian heritage was invented in these boardrooms from 1947 to the early 50s. So they backfit a religious history on America. And in this One Nation Under God report, they wrote in there, I was going through the report, and it says that to win the Cold War, there is a, quote, need to weld religion to democracy. So they coined this term, "In God We Trust," and then they pushed forward real quickly this legislation to add it to our coins, adding "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. All this happened in rapid fire fashion. And then they printed, I think it was something like 681,000 copies, Congress did, and paid to distribute it, which was really, you know, trying to religious theme of our nation, patriotism.
Right. You use the term sacralization.
Yeah, sacralization. That's right. It backfit, basically. They started the Congressional Prayer Room, and then they made the stained glass window of George Washington bowing there at Valley Forge, which basically they were just sort of playing on making him a saint, like you would see, you know, the saints and stained glass windows and churches and things like that. And in the reports that they released, that Congress released, they changed the national motto to "In God We Trust," and the report said that it had, quote, psychological value to do that. And there was some debate in Congress about whether this was like exploiting religion, and it was decided that any debate would be a sign of disloyalty to the nation. So it gets worse. By 1951, Truman set up a psychological, psychological strategy board, which had the CIA and State Department officials. They were studying the domestic use of, quote, the potential role of religion in psychological warfare, which should raise the eyebrows of your readers. And it says that they wrote of, quote, seeking the use of religion as a Cold War instrumentality. And they used a three-person council of religious leaders to investigate the moral and religious factors of psychological warfare. And through that, to emphasize the spiritual roots of U.S. institutions and the religious component of major holidays, including just making it up, like saying that the 4th of July was always a religious holiday, which is preposterous if you think about it. But that's what they sold and what the people ate. And these were the people who were the propagandists of World War II that were normally used against our enemies using black propaganda. But this was turned against our own country. One of the groups that has a pretty menacing name was called the Foundation for Religious Action in Social and Civil Order, or FRASCO, which is basically, you know, a control group. Their members included Billy Graham, Henry Ford II, Herbert Hoover, and many CEOs, as well as the Hollywood's Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. So, you know, this Foundation for Religious Action and Social and Civil Order, you get the clear picture that religion was being used as a tool. None of this had anything to do with being right with God or trying to, you know, where you're going to go when you die or trying to find eternal life. It was all co-opting it to serve a near-term political end.
Right. You also include that, wasn't there some intel people too? Wasn't Frank Wisner in there? I think he was a heavy duty.
Yes. He was part of it too, from the old mighty Wurlitzer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that Operation Mockingbird, wasn't it? The CIA.
So they're just starting right there, right after the war, and all justified under Cold War type of environment, right? The Ruskies justified it all.
Right. Now, and they all, but in this book, this particular book, I've written about them in the past, Paley at CBS and others that basically doing the bidding of the CIA and the information we were receiving. But the focus in this book is where they decided religion, and Christianity specifically, was to be bastardized to basically serve their purpose rather than the eternal purposes that it was intended for. And America ate it up, and they've never been the same since then, to the point that the generations that came after that, we look back and think that's the way America always was back to the beginning. But there was just a few years of time. For example, they did these things called freedom pledges, where you had to sign, and they put a lot of pressure on you in front of everybody, your neighbors, to sign these freedom pledges that you would, you know, fight for freedom. And they would take them down to the altar of churches. So they would have Freedom Sunday, where they wanted all churches to preach some freedom message. And then in front of all of your neighbors and fellow parishioners, you'd have to go sign on the altar your pledge to America, which is really ironic to me, because I've always seen the church as sort of an embassy of another kingdom, you know, a heavenly kingdom. And, you know, it had a bigger agenda than just, you know, short-term patriotism. But they would go in the Sugar Bowl. There were something like 70,000 people all in unison who signed these kind of things. It was like what you'd picture North Korea, what they would do.
Right.
But they...
with an American, you know, they would flavor actually, to it, right?
Do what?
With an American flavor to it.
To American flavor to
well,
it.
Yeah.
Start and stretch. Right. They had freedom train documents, and every town had stopped. You had to go see it. Ironically, it was the exact same thing Vladimir Lenin did with the October Revolution. He had this. They got the idea from him in the train that had all of their revolutionary documents. They actually did that in America to psychologically weld religious belief with something that was uniquely American. And partly the reason why the CEOs got involved, one is, they had the most to lose if something like socialism or communism came in, because it could start nationalizing, you know, what they were making money on themselves. But their value system about not having government help for the poor, or having a regulatory function when people were doing something that could actually harm workers or harm the communities where factories were, this was all a threat. And so they worked all that message into this religious message. And to the point they even decided, I don't know if you had known this before you read this, but Truman was committed to making universal mandatory military training for everybody in America. Where everybody had to go into the military for X amount of time. And what they decided was we could... make an advanced soldier by putting religion into the teaching of the advanced soul of the soldier. And they did something they called Father Divine's Heaven, or General Divine's Heaven. And they did this test case program, pilot program at Fort Knox, where they take all the 18-year-olds that graduated from high school, and every one of them would have to go into this military. And they would basically deluge them with about 6 hours of religious training a day. And the military officers would first ask them if what religion they were part of, and if they'd make a commitment for Christ, and they would have to do it on the spot. And of course, here's your commanding officer telling you that you need to make this religious decision. And then they would have to meet all week with their chaplains and others for, you know, hours and hours and hours every day of religious training. Anything that was in poor taste had to be purged from any of the barracks. They turned the bartenders in the bars outside the base into snoops, who, if they went in to get a drink, they would be told on. And so what they did was they just basically, like I said, they were making them mujahideen, holy warriors. And they admitted that. That's what they were trying to do, is use religion to make them better killing machines. So that when they would go into battle, they would be remorseless killing them, because it was a holy war that they were doing. The only bad thing was, is when they started backing off of that in the mid-60s, the soldiers went back to their old selves, being what we think of soldiers being, you know, going out on weekend leave and living up and those kind of things. But they kept it for the generals. So the general still went through all this training, including like how you had to observe all the Ten Commandments and all these other kind of things that they taught about the Christian destiny, the Christian purpose of America, that God had ordained America to be, you know, like the new Israel. Right. And all of this was trained by still to generals, I think up until this day, senior officers and generals. And I'm sure guys like Jerry Boykin, who I do a lot of writing about, who sort of considered, you know, him on a holy crusade. You know, he's the one that teaches that when Jesus comes back, he'll be using an AK-47. He was the guy that was over the whole Black Hawk Down operation and over all of our special forces in the military. And he has this extreme radical belief system. And so this is the stuff that came out of that era. So didn't mean to take up too much of your time talk about the business side, but it really just shows how easily we can be co-opted, an entire nation. In our religion, we can just hand it over for some kind of temporary purpose without any question. Of course, they were deluged with ads on TV shows, like guys like Charlton Heston, John Wayne, all of the Jimmy Stewart, all these ones were part of this program to make this divine destiny of America in Christian terms. Cecil B. DeMille was one of the main producers of it. And so people were just, it was on TV nonstop. They were buying thousands of newspaper ads every week and hundreds of newspaper. They had the Freedom Hour broadcast that went on television. So they were being, it was sort of like how talk radio and cable is today. They were being deluged with this message and all sorts of peer pressure by these famous people, people they looked up to, role models, then their own neighbors. And after a while, you forget why you even believe in God or what was the real purpose all about.
Right. I mean, but it was all for political purposes. It was all subsumed under this goal, post-war, creation of the national security state and all that stuff. Really, the post-war aims of the U.S. and really led to incredible international effects. If you take those ideologies and we're here to save the world. Look at all the governments we overthrew in the 50s and 60s, right? So you can see, I think, a connection between this sacralization of Christianity and really the dawning of the U.S. power over really almost every country up until maybe China.
Yeah. Guys like Eric Prince were taught this stuff. You know, he went through the Navy SEALs. Between that and his family were like heavy shakers in the Dutch reform movement in Michigan. They were major players of that. And it's all real hard line kind of belief system. And that's why when later he formed Blackwater and his other mercenary outfits, you know, everybody who worked for him, when they testified at trial, talked about him seeing himself as a knight, like a crusader. And that what they were on was a holy crusade in Iraq and elsewhere, to lay the rag heads out on the carpet. That's what he was taught. So that's the mindset of the people who were cultivated through this. And
there were some heavy duty slaughters associated with Blackwater too. Just guys blowing people away.
Oh yeah.
That's all this.
And they were, and in fact, I think our last president had to pardon some of them that were already convicted at trial of just, you know, unprovoked massacres they did of civilians.
That's my life all over again.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm a religious person myself. I'm a practicing Christian. And that makes me even more disgusted because it actually perverts. It makes it ugly. And I recognize how powerful it is and how powerful it can be a motivator for people doing things that their conscience wouldn't even allow them. But to be fair, there is some historical element, even though they invented a lot of this back history from the late 40s on. If you look back to the Puritans, you know, the Puritans came from a hardcore Calvinist teaching of election, and they believed that they were the chosen people, just like Israel was, and that's why they had no problem massacring Indians and other people that they encountered, because in their belief system, those people had been doomed by God even before they were born to the lake of fire. So why not help them out getting there? Because God had already decreed that they were worthless and they were the elect chosen, you know, priesthood. And so they called them in the historical things. You look at the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they called them Amalekites, which was the word in the Bible right. for people who were unredeemable.
Right. And that goes back to Moses's time, right? Amalek yeah. was constant. And they still actually, Israel's and some very ultra Orthodox Jews tag people as Amalek. I think, who was the guy?
Anybody who stands in their way. Right. Anybody who stands in their right. way. And that way you don't have a conscience about taking them out because, you know, God hates these people. So why don't we? So I just use that example to show that people like to pride themselves that are, you know, Christians like I was raised and, hey, we're the wise people to help the rest of society. And the information they have could do that if they stuck with it. But how easily they have let themselves be led by the nose. And then in the bulk of this chapter talks about how big business on their own went and cut a deal with the first prosperity gospel preacher and formed what we now know as Christian mass media. And it was not only bankrolled by corporate America from the beginning, but it was done explicitly for their interest. And it created a gospel that put the Bible message on its ear because it was a corporate America agenda that the mass media built. And that's what I document in my book.
Great. And can you talk to people about this, who you call or you reference as the apostle of millionaires, James Fifield?
Yeah. James Fifield, now he was called that by reporters. He came out, I think it was in 1935, to that First Congregational Church there. You know, it was sort of a prominent church, but it was on the ropes. It was going under. A lot of their resources went to sort of helping the poor and needy in the community. And he put a quick stop to that. And what he did was he targeted the powerful elite in Southern California in those early days. He got Cecil B. DeMille to go to his church. And I think he was on his board, actually. And a lot of, like, the guy who was the head of Southern California Edison, William Mullendore, he got him on there, and all of these powerful figures in Southern California. And he was called the apostle to the millionaires because he sort of sounded like more of a Zig Ziglar, like your business talk, like you might hear in a multi-level marketing thing. Mm-hmm. He was theologically very, very liberal. He said he didn't really care about what the Bible said. I mean, he was on the record saying that, but the kind of things that mattered to big business and the wealthy is what he embraced. For example,
and interesting, sorry to interrupt, but it is interesting yeah. because the Congregational Church is on Wilshire here. And if you go just a little bit west from his very prominent, well, you know, it's almost like a cathedral that's the size of that Congregational Church, but they call it Millionaire's Row. So right down Wilshire, and you see a very prominent Masonic building. So he was right in that mix during that time of the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned Masonic building because the guy who took over his, quote, ministry later was the guy who was one of the main operators of the Philosophical Research Society. Right. I think that's is that Obadiah Harris's group that Manly P. Hall founded?
Manly P. Hall. Yeah, it sounds right. He was probably at so that main. There's a huge building. There's a huge Masonic temple on in Millionaire's Row on Wilshire, right in the center of LA.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this church was deep in debt. He came in, started preaching this pro-business message, you know, power positive thinking thing. He got all these wealthy going, paid off their debts quickly. But at the same time, the New Deal was going on because the Great Depression had hit. Just a few years before that, we had a quarter to a third of our nation was out of work. And that was a time of instability around the world. And, you know, in Germany, they didn't get a handle on that, the unrest and the people unemployed. And then you got extremist groups like the Nazis come to power. And that was the fascists did the same thing in Italy. And so that's happening in parts of the world. And it looked really bad in America. And so what happened was this New Deal and like jobs programs to put people at work building dams or, you know, cutting roads and highways through forests and things like that. they put them to work so these people weren't shiftless and on the street and having revolutionary thoughts when they're desperate. Well, that rubbed big business the wrong way. And big business was already on the ropes because they were still perceived as having led America into the Great Depression because of their greed and their hubris, trying to make money for nothing in the stock market, you know, in big bubbles that burst. Right. And so they weren't getting anywhere with that. But they had this New Deal, and the New Deal was trying to get Social Security, where people who were elderly had like a bare minimum of money to get food. Like they wanted pensions for the military who had served in combat. Any of this jobs programs, they were threatened by. And so the National Association of Manufacturers had their annual conference in 1940 at the Waldorf Astoria. And it was a big deal back then. It was a big deal publicly. They were an important group. And they had it televised live on the radio coast to coast. And most of their budget went to trying to promote the values of big business that, you know, unions were evil, that government regulation was evil, worker standards were evil, pensions were evil, any of this kind of stuff to help the individual or common man. But the problem was, is that their reputation was horrible because of their blame that they were perceived for the Great Depression. And so they were getting nowhere with all this money spent. But this guy showed up, this Reverend Fifield, 1940, showed up and gave a talk on national radio at their convention saying that, you know, there's only one group of people in America that still have any trust of the American public right now, that you are a fool for not exploiting, and that's the clergy. And he said, what you need to do is take this business message about government being evil, or public assistance or jobs or whatever being evil, and you need to run it through them, sort of, again, sacredize it, Christianize it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to just sort of put a minus sign in front of everything Jesus said. But if you do that, that is your way to get traction in America. Well, it was said to have electrified the crowd. And so all of these people beat a path to fund this guy to basically build up this organization called Spiritual Mobilization. Not surprisingly, although you had like the Chryslers, Westinghouse, these other people that were throwing money at it, the biggest were the oil men. Because the oil men, you know, they suddenly became rich overnight, not long ago before that. But they also came out from Texas and other kind of conservative areas. You know, they weren't born into elite status. So a lot of them were very, very religious in their upbringing, or, you know, a very fundamentalist belief system. Mm-hmm. And so they put that fundamentalism of their upbringing with their sudden wealth and use that to create what we now know as conservative Christian media. And the ringleader was a fellow, J. Howard Pugh. And J. Howard Pugh, he's probably best known, other than he and his father founded Sunoco. He also was the one who basically was the main bankroller of Grove City College. But he's known for having founded Christianity Today. And in my book, I talk about how when Billy Graham and his other assistant, Carl Henry, when they were approached by J. Howard Pugh, they made an agreement, and I quote them in there, that they would not say anything in Christianity Today in support of unions or in support of anything that would work against labor relations or the interest of corporate America as a prerequisite to get the money from J. Howard Pugh. But he was the main funder of James Fifield in Spiritual Mobilization, his TV program, all of the ads and newspapers, his newsletters. And
wasn't his newsletter was Faith and Freedom? Is that right?
Faith and Freedom.
And Freedom.
Right.
Right. But there's also, just a sec, there's also the Pugh Trust. And I think the Pugh, like, this money is still around. So they're still putting money around even to this day. So it started back then. But also, I think they do have a polling arm as well, Pugh. So still influential to this day.
Oh, yeah. They're very influential and probably the most trusted Christian polling organization. But to be fair to the Pugh Charitable Trust, just like a lot of other foundations and trusts, once the founder died, people inside who took it over gradually started steering it in a little bit different direction. So I don't want to completely implicate the modern day Pew Charitable Trust or others. Now, if they deserve it, they deserve it. But actually, a lot of these guys, the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Pews, they had really, really extreme views. And later people started getting into the management of the foundations as they got old and moved on. It started veering them in other directions, for better or for worse. But J. Howard Pugh, from my perspective, the more he comes up, he is more and more of a villain in showing the worst of what came up. He was raised, I call him a dour Presbyterian. He was raised in a super strict Presbyterian, which was mean Calvinist, you know, viewpoint, very elect centered. Mm-hmm. He was known as a teetotaler, really, really tight on his morals. But I'll share something with you that's not in the book. I'm going to put it in the second one. But mm-hmm. something you might be interested about is a California connection. I went and got some records on J. Howard Pugh at the library in Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware, that has all his records, because he was one of the main robber barons of the first half of the 20th century. I think he died around 1971. But in his records, I saw these folders they had, and one of them said Bohemian Grove.
Interesting.
And I guess you remember Bohemian Grove, correct?
Very well. I think it just happened this month, right? I think they're there now or something.
Yeah, usually July. July mm-hmm. is when they have the cremation of care and the hijinks. Well, anyway, and you got to remember, this guy's like a real hyper-fundamentalist guy, okay? Teetotaler, very careful who he caroused with. Well, I asked them to send me the folder, and they didn't even know it was in the records at the university. So I got them to send me the records, and what do you know? It has all of his notes about when he went to Bohemian Grove in 1947. Now, he stayed at a camp called the Caveman Camp. The Caveman is where not only J. Edgar Hoover, that was his camp, and he was there alongside J. Howard Pugh, but also Richard Nixon was in the Caveman Camp at Bohemian Grove. But in these records, he was invited by a guy. Now, one thing you may not know, but J. Howard Pugh was one of the ringleaders of the business plot of 1933. Are you familiar much with the business plot?
Was that the one that was exposed by War is a Racket? That guy wrote
yeah,
that book?
Smedley yeah. Butler. That's Smedley right. Butler,
thank you, yeah.
Yeah. Smedley Somewhat Butler.
Familiar. Bush's daddy was involved in that, I think. Prescott Bush.
Yeah.
Grandpa.
Right. But it was an alliance of corporate, the head of DuPont, Remington, the head of General Motors, E.F. Hutton, the governor of New York, and the American Legion was involved. And it was an attempt to overthrow our government, literally overthrow it, by deputizing the disgruntled World War I veterans and putting him under Smedley Butler to basically overthrow our government, put him on the cabinet, and make FDR a puppet. And Smedley Butler was a true patriot. He played along, got the press involved, and then when they were ready to start the overthrow, he went straight to Congress with the information. The press was very skeptical about it, but the Congress report that I got in final proved that it was real. And one right. of the people that was a ringleader mentioned was this J. Howard Pugh. Now, wow. the guy who invited him to Bohemian Grove, and again, this is sort of extracurricular to my book, but it'll be in volume two. I'm going to add it. The guy who invited him was the guy who ran a group called the Crusaders. And the Crusaders was sort of a neo-Nazi kind of group. They had been fingered in congressional reports as Nazi sympathizer group. And they were also part of this whole thing to try to overthrow the government. Because even the American Legion back in those days had made Mussolini their man of the year.
Wow.
Because they believed that fascism was the wave of the future. And so this guy from the Sentinels was also a big businessman. And he invited J. Howard Pugh to come for that weekend, 2 weeks. Well, first of all, I thought J. Howard Pugh is going to be so offended when he sees the debauchery of Bohemian Grove, he's going to go there and immediately turn back around, even though he likes being with other elites. Turns out, as I go into the record, found out he'd stayed there a full 2 weeks, the full 2 weeks of the meeting.
Right.
And then I thought, well, first of all, it was 1947. One of the other guys, I don't know if this name rings a bell with you around that period of time. Do you remember a high-level scientist by the name of Vannevar Bush?
Yes, I'm familiar with Vannevar Bush. For some reason, he was, wasn't he the one who had oversaw Tesla stuff? Or he was out of the East Coast. He sounds familiar. I know Vannevar Bush.
He was the ringleader of the basically back engineer UFO technology mentioned in the Majestic 12 documents.
Right, that's where. Yeah.
Now, I don't know if those documents are authentic or not. That's not my point. My point is that's what he was famous. He was basically the Dr. Strangelove of post-war American spooky science.
Right.
And the work on the post-war nuclear program was done and planned at Bohemian Grove.
Right.
I went out and got the historical records. It was all done there. Well, he was there the same weekend, staying in the same camp. So you have J. Edgar Hoover, you have J. Howard Pugh, you have the Sentinel guy, you've got Vannevar Bush and all these other interesting people. But I thought, you know, J. Howard Pugh, one thing he's not going to go for because he's such a serious Christian, he was an elder in the National Presbyterian Council, is that when he sees cremation of care, there's no way he's going to stick around for that. Well, as I go through the records, I find out there is an actual handbill that they pass out around the campfire in the water there for a cremation of care ceremony that explains in detail by the originator of that ceremony, who explains the deeper meanings, where it talks about that even the lower level Bohemian Grove members don't understand the esoteric meaning of Bohemian Grove. And this is from the author that did the whole mystery play. And the notes at the top are in J. Howard Pugh's own hand saying, "This is wonderful. This is the most wonderful." You know where they do a mock sacrifice effigy of someone, and this hellish screams and demons appear, and cackling, they're all robed with torches and stuff. It's a mystery play is what it is. And like in old Greece and Rome. And he just thought it was the most wonderful thing in the world. Yeah, another thing I noticed was that being a teetotaler, you know, stayed away from alcohol completely, that he just marveled in his notes on the wine list and all of the wonderful wines there that were from around the world and just wonderful things that he enjoyed. Because it's basically nonstop decadent drinking.
Right, they drink all day. It's like 24-hour binge.
It's a bacchanalia. And, you know, later in the book, I talk about some of the leading figures in the libertarian movement that founded it. Leonard Reed was one of them. And I got a hold of his records, his journal notes, when he went to Bohemian Grove. I think it was in 54. And so it's the first time I've ever seen someone there actually writing their notes, and it had been preserved in his records. And he explained that it was just, you know, a veritable orgy of drunkenness. But that's where he went and built his program and raised his money for the Bohemian Grove. So I didn't mean to get off on this. Another thing that J. Howard Pugh really funded was the anti-Semitic / neo-Nazi movement. There's a guy, Willis Carto.
Willis Carto, yeah, I'm familiar with Carto.
Yeah, if that name rings a bell from the spotlight, and Holocaust denier, people who'd been in his office. I have his FBI records of Willis Carto, and people who came to the FBI office that went to go work on his copy or whatever showed pictures of Hitler everywhere in his office and Nazi flags and everything. Well, while he was doing all that, one of the guys that bankrolled him was J. Howard Pugh. And J. Howard Pugh also, in his FBI record I have, was a snitch to Hoover on everybody else in industry that he was involved with. Wow. And he was, in fact, Hoover had to tell him to calm down because Pew wanted Hoover to lock everybody up or do, you know, agent provocateur activity or whatever. And even J. Edgar Hoover had to tell him to cool it a little bit. So these are the guys who started what we know as conservative Christian media.
But you actually, just to interrupt one thing, you did mention the libertarianism, because I think that's an important element of that early, their justification for their view of Christianity was this, we're actually libertarians, and this justifies our actions and what we can do and why these other people are poor. So I think that's an important component to recognize in Fifield's outlook.
Well, you know what's sad about it is that, yeah, that basically they coined the term Christian libertarianism to coin his version of it, where he sort of contorted scripture, where you had no obligation to your brother or your neighbor, and you weren't your brother's keeper. But what's sad is that back when I was doing my Future Quake show, I was very sympathetic to libertarianism belief. It was new to me. And there was a lot of stuff I found inspirational. And if you go watch and, or listen to my old radio shows, you'll find a lot of stuff that's sort of sympathetic to it. And I explained it this way. I said, you know, I walked through the libertarian garden and I found some legitimate flowers in those gardens, like right of free association, self-determination, you know, not imposing your will on other people, these kind of things. And so, and those are real flowers, and they've helped me be a better person. But the more I dug down into it, I found a lot of weeds under those flowers. And there were so much weeds of what I would call social Darwinism or the law of the jungle that I had to just keep on moving. I held on to those flowers, but, you know, I had to keep going, because there's two camps in the early days of the libertarian movement that are still influential, both heavily ideological. You had the Ayn Rand camp,
right,
which was very much a atheist, not just atheist, but super anti Christian belief. In fact, the head of the Ayn Rand Institute, I just got an article not long ago from Fox News where he tells America, you either have to pick Jesus Christ or Ayn Rand. Wow. And this whole thing about turning the other cheek makes you a sucker. And this was on FoxNews.com. And if you pick that, you're a sucker. If you worry about other people, and they're just going to push you around. But you have that belief system that had absolute contempt for anybody that felt like there was a higher power you were accountable to. And then there was another side that was equally scary. And that was the group that was into the very esoteric Gnostic New Age belief system, and those people were equally influential in the founding of American libertarianism. Guys like Leonard Reed and a few other figures, this Mullendore guy and others, they formed this foundation, and they were acolytes of these gurus and were having seances and were actually conjuring spirits and things like this. That was the whole libertarian world was doing this thing, and they bound together because they were both into the every person for themselves movement in pro-business, anti-taxes, but they had two different ways of getting to it. But the ones that were into the weird religious stuff, again, all based out of Southern California, your neck of the woods, were the ones that were writing in these Christian newsletters for conservative clergy. Right. They were the religious teaching, and they, you know, they were channeling spirits. They believed in all sorts of cult religions and, you know, making
perennial philosophy, all kinds of strange stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Theosophy, that kind of thing. And as I show in the book, those are the ones that were writing for these newsletters targeted to conservative Christian clergy. But spiritual mobilization, went to almost all the clergy in America, and they had so much money from the corporate world, just like how Christian media does today with all the corporate money they get, that they were doing these contests where pastors in churches around the country would get $5,000 if they would preach a pro-Christian message. Now, their parishioners didn't know about this, but this is like they used to talk about in the Bible about Balaam, the prophet. Balaam was a prophet for hire, and he'd tell you whatever you want to know for the right money. And he became a symbol of that. And that's what these people became. They were like Balaams. They were mercenary preachers, basically, for hire. And so that was the power of spiritual mobilization. They had a show that was on like 500 or 600 radio stations promoting this. Again, government is evil. All government is evil. Anything good in society comes from the minds of our most powerful businessmen. That's the redeeming part. Their genius and wisdom is what makes America great. Labor relations, unions were evil. Wages were evil, or wage increases. And you get the picture.
Right.
But they were able to train all of the seminary professors, senior clergy officials and bishops. And it perpetrated right through down to the pew. And, now, after a few generations, we don't know that there was anything different.
Right.
But then, there was a time when people cared about others.
Right. And they're spending money in public relations. So they're definitely really trying to get their ideology cemented back then through society. So it's very important to understand.
I will tell you, I've learned this in general. If whatever you want to do just happen to line up with the agenda of some very, very rich people, you're going to have a very easy way of going at it. Because all the resources you need to do what you want will be made available to you.
That's fascinating. And my last interview was on the Council on National Policy, and it's that same kind of feel to it. It's supposedly Christian, but I think it's very similar to this five-field spiritual mobilization. It's
same not, people.
Yeah. No, you're right. Same people, but it's also the same. It's very similar in ideological outlook. It's like a quasi-Christian. They're all Christians, but there's a lot of money there, and there's huge powerful families, and they're getting their brand of it out there. And there's a lot of Balaam-like figures, not really talking about Christianity, but talking definitely being puppeteered, in my opinion.
Well, and you know, those meetings are secret too. Yeah, you can't totally go into those meetings.
Yeah, it's invitation only.
It's what they do in darkness. Now, you know, one time I interviewed Jerome Corsi. You probably remember him.
I brought up about
him being part of that.
Yep.
And he actually invited me on air to go to one of the meetings.
Interesting.
He said, oh, you can come. Oh, there's no surprises there. Now, you know, if I went to something like that, I'm going to get the dog and pony show. I'm going to get the Potemkin Village. I'm not going to get where the, you know, real decisions are made or anything like that. They give stuff for public consumption, if that.
Right.
But
they have little like axioms, little phrases. Mike, they have like little phrases even on their website that are palatable little metaphors for the public. You know, this is what we really think. But behind that, there's a lot more behind that curtain, baby. No question.
Well, and they'll sprinkle to gullible Christians. They'll use words like Judeo-Christian tradition. They might even say Jesus, but they don't want to, you know, they don't want to insult the Jewish component that they rely on. But they will use these kind of words. And as I mentioned earlier in this interview, those catchphrases were invented in boardrooms with PSYOPs people and propagandists. They don't go back to the founding of our country. They were done in concert with senior clergy officials and then used the mass media to hard sell it into our heads, as if that's the way the world had always been, was that way. And one, they didn't care about any kind of real agenda for real Christianity. That was not their concern. It was a powerful tool that they could use to make their agenda. But a lot of this action and its roots, believe it or not, center on the area where you live, right there in Southern California. And even before this period of time, in the late 30s and on, that's when guys like Gerald Hurd showed up, as you've read about, started dealing with the Theosophist and Krishnamurti, and you had all these strange teachers. And I just think where you live must have been an interesting melting pot in the 20s and 30s.
It was, and 40s. It still kind of is, because I drive by these places, the Center for Philosophical Research, drive by there all the time. I mean, I live here, so I see all these buildings with this five-field history. I see Hurd's name bandied about. I know all these people.
Gerald Hurd.
They all have a Crowley connection. So Huxley, Krishnamurti, All these characters, Heard probably, I haven't solidified that, but I can tell you, Christopher Isherwood, all these guys have, who knew Crowley, actually. So you, and Crowley, you know, rolled through here and said it was the land of hucksters and stuff like that and got out. But,
well, you know, Gerald Heard is a central figure in my book in the next chapter after this, because he was providing the spiritual teaching for Fifield's organization. But I came across some information where Jack Parsons and Crowley mentioned Gerald Heard.
Interesting.
And they mentioned him very derogatorily because he was a rival. And so you have this melting pot there in Southern California where you had guys like Manly P. Hall, Gerald Heard, who had a huge following, Igor Stravinsky, Steve Allen, Charlie Chaplin, Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo. These were all following Gerald Heard. And then you had Jack Parsons doing his thing, you know,
right down the street.
Toward the 40s.
Right down the street from Heard.
Yeah, Pasadena. Yeah.
Now, even closer. So the rituals used to take place right there in Hollywood. So he was really about 8 blocks away from the Vedanta Society, which is right there. If they were, you know,
now, was this the place where John Carradine would go down there and participate in it?
So the temple, the original temple, the original Crowley OTO temple was off of Hollywood Boulevard. And it was on the third story. And there's pictures of Parsons there doing a ritual with all of Crowley's design in the background, designed of the kind of temple based upon Orthodox Christianity. So, but that building got torn down and then they had moved everything back to Pasadena after that, after Parsons kind of became the head. But there was a character before whose name I can't remember, who was really pre-Parsons, and Crowley passed over him and made Parsons the head and called Parsons the most important OTO member. But it's literally right down the street from where Heard was hanging out at this Vedanta Society, which is still there. So there's all, I mean, you can throw in Hubbard and all these other characters and their followers. It's just a very hitty mix. But we're almost at an hour, Mike. We covered the intro to Babylon's Gnostic Sorcerers. We're covering it a little bit for 5 minutes. But I'll have to have you back and you can go in greater detail on that.
We didn't even cover, you know, we talked a lot about how Fifield set the stage of all of this and basically had the majority of America's clergy in his hand. But there were other people who got in on his act, like Howard Kirshner and Christian Economics, which he also had, you know, Pew's money and other people's money coming. You know, Billy Graham had his oil man, Sid Richardson, bankroll him. But they started pushing this thing about how when Western nations like America colonialized Africa, that was the good old days for Africa, and they were lucky to be colonized. And this was all for Christian clergy to read. And then maybe we can come back and talk about the next generation that sort of took over, because this in the mid-50s, that organization, Spiritualization, went hardcore New Age. I mean, they went into all sorts of weird spirit channeling and some other 12-step programs and things we can talk about were part of it. But then after the next generation out that went hardcore neo-Nazi. The top Christian media, well, from the 50s to the 70s, the top ranked as far as money, income, number of TV stations, Christian shows were shows that were hardcore Nazi extreme right, like I just blanked out his name. He has a three-person name. He's from the Deep South, from Arkansas. I'll think of his name in a minute. Billy James
Never
Hargis.
Heard of that. I don't know that name.
Who was? Well, you go back through that chapter and look up Billy James Hargis. There's a wonderful index in this book. So the cast of millions in this book, you go back in the index. Took me forever to build it. But you'll go in there and you'll find Billy James Hargis' involvement with the Little Rock bombings that the FBI was involved with, his involvement with the general where they were tailing JFK around, including in Dallas a couple days before, putting up posters with bullseyes on JFK's head a couple days before he got there.
Right. That was the Hunt brothers, right? think I just talked about that too. CNP, my CNP.
Well, Hunt Brothers had their role in all this too. But the general that was involved in the sedition there at the University of Mississippi, another general that your listeners are trying to remind me of, and I can't think of his name. It's in the book. But the pendulum swung where you had this really, really hard right ultranationalist, Holocaust denying, anti-Jew, was the main Christian media. And these were the guys who taught Jerry Falwell, taught the guys who formed the religious right. They worked for these people.
Wow.
So by 79, the next generation of the people that we're more familiar with, the Pat Robertsons, these back people took over, but they were trained by these people who were doing things that most nobody knows about. And that's why I try to document that in the book. But once you know it, you start thinking, oh, no wonder people are so screwed up in the head. And it has nothing to do with what's in the Bible, has nothing to do with the gospel or anything like that. But it's all this other stuff. It's all this other crap.
Right.
And the agenda that was behind dishing it out, that once you start seeing that, it's almost you have a little bit of empathy for people on how confused they are today and why we have insurrections and other kind of weird stuff going on, is because people have been really screwed up in the head for a few generations.
Generations, right.
And hopefully this will get some answers for people. And if you'll continue to have me back, we got a lot more to mine here. But,
we got a long way to go. Where's the best place for people to get the book?
Thank you for asking. Amazon has it in paperback, their ebook version, a Kindle, and you can even get some hardcovers there. Barnes & Noble has it in all forms, their Nook ebook form and paperback and two kinds of hardcover. I mean, you'll find it at Walmart and Target and places like that too. I would be so grateful if you got it. Not only is it gives me a couple bucks to cover some of my expenses, but something that I was writing about the other day was about a study from 1969 where they found that if people get their information from screens, like flickering screens like TV or computers, there definitely is an alpha wave function in the brain that basically relaxes and puts your discerning left side of your brain to sleep, where you take in information without critiquing it and you don't even know you have. But when you read printed material, and this is according to academic studies, printed material puts your brain in a beta brainwave state, which allows you to be more discerning. You actually can reflect on the history and what you've learned, and you can be wiser in digesting thoughts, ideas, and information. So just for reasons like that, I highly recommend people will get books, either one like mine or ones that I recommend in my book. There's a whole bunch of them, new and old, or others, or your books. When they take the time to read a book, you do a better quality job of distilling out something that makes sense into a worldview for you. So,
you mentioned a lot of books in this book that I'd never read. One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, Cross of Iron, yeah. Harriet Truman and the Origins of the National Security State. So there's a lot of extra things.
Some of them are old. Yeah, mm-hmm. There a lot of them are hot linked in the book. So you can find them on archive.org. You can find some places or, different places where you can actually even look online or buy it used for a couple bucks. But the Two Spies Report is where I write on more contemporary stuff. And it's still long-winded. It's like reading a book if you read my blog post there. But it, a lot of stuff that honks people off. If you don't mind being offended, I would love to have you drop by Two Spies Report. MikeBennettBooks.com. I'll make announcements of other interviews. In fact, I've got both of these interviews. I need to get updated on that site too, because they'll be there archived as well. So thank you so much. And I thank your audience for putting up with this. But there's so much more to talk about. I'm just hitting a few high spots. But thank you for the forum, because I know your listeners are discerning and they're truth seekers. And most people out there listen to podcasts or just want to be entertained. They want their ears tickled or foolishness, and your folks want to know what's going on, and I hope this discussion helps it a little bit.
I think so. I think you're right, and I think this discussion will. So it's the second part of our discussion of J. Michael Bennett's book titled Two Masters and Two Gospels, Volume 1, the teaching of Jesus first, the leaving of the Pharisees, and talk radio and cable news. Thanks so much, Mike. Have a great one.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. All right.